The Night Owl Podcast, Episode 29, Maddie's Part 2. Welcome to the Night Owl Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Ballou, and this is a place for all you restless spirits out there to tune in and hear true tales of the paranormal. I hunt these stories down, capture them from the mouths of those who experience them, and share them with you right here. If you have a story to tell, we're currently looking for more personal ghost stories, so if you or someone you know has one, please submit it to us for consideration. Go to thenightowlpodcast.com, click on the Submit Your Story page, and let us hear your ghost story. We'd love to consider it for the show. Receiving a random message on Facebook stating that a place called Maddie's at Green Pastures had 4 resident ghosts piqued my interest enough to look into this claim as a new potential case. Come to find out, Maddie's is a recently renovated restaurant, bar, and wedding venue, but more interestingly, it was housed in a historic mansion with an enduring, colorful history. Now deemed an Austin Historic Landmark, the home in which Maddie resides dates back to 1895 and was witness to many families living through landmark events, including the 2 World Wars. Now, staff at Maddie's are coming forward with unexplained experiences, and it's more than just dismissible occurrences like glasses falling off of shelves or lights flickering. There have been 2 very significant full-bodied apparition sightings by 2 separate employees here. More impressive is that what each reported seeing matched, almost to a T. And even more incredible, both employees hadn't shared their experiences with one another yet. But what really elevated this case to a level of interest for me was the story of the wandering psychic, Cindy, who appeared one day claiming that the spirits of the home had called her to Maddie's. She was allowed to sit in the home and absorb all that she could. In the end, she produced a booklet of notes detailing the spirits that seemingly haunted this home, including their histories and their wishes. It was an incredible story, but I wanted to know more. I wanted to investigate Maddie's myself and see where this fascinating case might lead us. Stay tuned. If you're new to the show, a quick note. This podcast is best devoured in chronological order, so we highly recommend that you stop here and begin your journey with us on Episode 1, Ink, Coffee, and Spirits. This episode is brought to you by Oh Boy Print Shop. When you need custom t-shirts, this shop's got your back. Crisp, clean t-shirt printing without setup fees or hidden costs, and always delivered on time. OhBoyPrintShop.com. That's OhBoy PrintShop.com. Mention the Night Owl Podcast and get $50 off your first order. It was approximately 10:55 p.m. on February 1st. I was parked, waiting in the vacant lot of one of my favorite cafes in the Baldwin Creek neighborhood, Thai Fresh. I'd fallen in love with this unique restaurant, bakery, and coffee house when I lived just up the road and could literally walk here regularly. But tonight, I wasn't here to grab a bite to eat or some coffee. In fact, the cafe was closed and all the lights were out. I simply was waiting for our clairvoyant friend Sarah to arrive. Since I don't reveal our locations to her prior to coming, I'd chosen Thai Fresh as our rendezvous point, since Maddie's was literally just a couple streets over. Soon enough, I saw Sarah approach in her car, so I waved to her to follow me in my truck. The streets here after 9 p.m. are quiet and dark. Even though it's a popular neighborhood in Austin, many of the establishments in this area aren't late-night venues, most closing their doors by about 9 p.m. I'd been in communication via text with manager Dustin. He'd informed me that they had some lingering patrons still in the bar, and he wanted me and the team to enter through the side entrance of Marion Hall first, and wait until the patrons were gone until fully exploring the entire house. So it's February 1st, 11 p.m. Alexis, Sarah, myself, and Tower here at Maddie's at Green Pastures in Austin, Texas. And we're working our way around the back to enter through Marion Hall. Okay, we're making our way up into the back patio of Marion Hall. Dustin is here to let us in.
There's the woman on the patio. That's immediate. She gave me the okay to come in. Room is full of people. I actually kind of want to go in somewhere. But this is all recorded. It's multiple recordings, and they just have a lot of activity. It's a lot of energy. So just in here, there's at least 4 active spirits and a lot of recorded. activity, I guess. Repetitive motions, that kind of stuff. I'm trying to get this woman to come in a little clearer. She's just kind of observing at the moment. I don't think she knows what to make of me just yet.
Already, the first spirit Sarah was picking out as a significant presence was a woman in Marion Hall. There seemed to be a ton of residual activity and a few passerbys, but you could see that Sarah was being pulled to this female presence. Now, it's something to take note of because Marion Hall is where Cindy, the visiting psychic, had said a woman spirit resides, and many of the staff, including Dustin here, refer to her as the caretaker. But after some time in this space, Sarah was being pulled to the women's restroom in Marion Hall, the space where, on her first visit, Dustin explained that employees feel very uncomfortable and oddly avoided these restrooms, even though they were nicer and more private than the others in the home.
That is a really... Here, let me back up.
Yeah.
Hold on, let me feel that again. That was weird. You need to stay out of the bathroom. It's a man. A little bit of a pervy man. It's okay. He's very touchy, so it's more like touching. So if I'm here by myself, I'll hear him. One, I'll hear like somebody shuffle in and then be like waiting to see who's going to go to the restroom if you're sitting in there. So,
what is he like?
He has a fascination with women's hair. Maybe in his late 20s. He's giving me a lot of jumbled images, so hang on real quick. Mm-hmm. Try to converse. It's almost like his mind was, maybe he was mentally ill, or maybe he was like, maybe he had some issue because the way he's piecing things together doesn't make sense. I'm trying to, he's giving me things out of order. And I'll work on the name because it's difficult. But for this one, women in there, men in there, it's going to sound like somebody came into the restroom. Like faucets for some reason, I'm like on and off water. You'll hear it, but it's not on. Or you'll feel like somebody's in the stall next to you, but they're not really there. Like, yeah, I'm in here by myself, but it doesn't feel like I'm alone. So it's gonna have that.
Sarah now hit on a small claim that Dustin had made, a presence that many feel in this specific restroom. The details in Sarah's description of the man was that he was young, seemed kind of creepy, and had a manner that seemed to indicate some form of mental illness. We still weren't going to give Sarah any information and were keeping her in the dark in the moment, so she finished here and moved us back into Marion Hall and shared a little bit more about the woman she felt was the strongest in this space.
Images here are going to be fun. So if people are taking party pictures or they're having a really good time, you're going to see images in the images. You're going to see other people in there that shouldn't be, either passing by or especially looking at the windows. So if you look at the windows, you're going to see that woman that kind of came in. This patio area would probably be notorious for catching her in images. She's almost like patrolling. She's walking around the whole space. She's probably going in further. I need to know how far she can get. But for right now, she's kind of guarding the top part of the patio area, in where the windows, especially along the windows. She's really not moving further into the room. So she's more like on the edges, like she's always watching things and making sure everything is going the way that it needs to go. But her presence is very, it's not heavy, but it's very kind of like she's making sure that everybody's good, right? Like, and you can feel that she's the one that's in charge. Like she's, I'm in charge of everything. I'm making sure everybody's all right. She'll probably temper moods, that kind of stuff. Weird, like very controlled. She's a very controlled person. I'm just trying to see if she can give me an image of herself, and she's not doing that. Just more feelings.
There were still staff cleaning up in the main house and kitchen areas, so Sarah took a moment to try to connect with this woman in Marion Hall again. We moved closer to the large windows circling the room, looking out onto the wraparound patio, and eventually Sarah did start to connect with her.
There she is.
The same one from in here?
Are you gonna give me a feel? Give me an image and a name. The trees. So there's something about the building across. Hold on, let me. She's. Wow, she knows this whole property. And then. The parties, okay, she likes that. Can I get it? I'm not gonna ask. Okay, go. And then that other man. children. Okay, so there's another man on that side. So where we walked in from, there's that building that's there. So there's something that she is telling me to go look in that building. So maybe there's somebody I need to talk to, give a message to, that kind of stuff. She's being very adamant about that.
Was it the house or the shed?
The bigger structure of the house. She's very insistent that I go over there, and there's a man there she needs to
deliver a message to,
yeah. So her boundaries are in this part of the property, but she goes all the way around. But the interesting thing is she's very familiar with everything. So what she showed me was like this in daylight. So all the trees, like no cars, so it's in a time that's different. It's like this wasn't here. The building itself was smaller. Like, it was all green, it was all grass, multiple trees, so, you know, the parking areas weren't here. So she's like, oh, like, this is what it used to look like. That's what she was giving me, that view. The activity here, she really likes. I think she's feeding off of the energy that happens here quite a bit. She's really, really enjoying it. I'm narrowing her age down, kind of like in her late 40s, I mean, like mid to late 40s, is what she's kind of giving me. But she's not really giving me, like, a full image of herself. It's really odd. Either I'm getting a half a face, like a shadowed, like she's a little veiled, and I don't know why she's like that. So I find it, I think it's just kind of odd that she's not giving me her whole self. I almost feel like she's going to be leaving soon. Like she just can't hold on to her form here. Whatever it is that she needed to do, she's already kind of finished it. This is probably the message that she's trying to send to him. Now the children, there's children that are running around the property. I don't know if they're associated with her or not, but they are running around, so I wasn't like, no, there is kids here, so I'm trying to, I said children, and it sent a different message for her. Okay, so there's, okay, so they are associated with her. Ooh, that was a lot of pain. So they must have passed, yeah, at least three is what I'm getting. Okay, can you, let me see, can you give me a name? Jesus, lots of messaging. Okay. Destiny, you're very popular. She's giving me like kind of like all these people's perspectives. People here late at night, getting spooked around, especially on the outside. Outside's a different, like those are all different animals. So I don't know if you want to get into all of that on the outside. Those are all different spirits.
We'll stay in here for now. Okay. And maybe towards the end when we go out there, we can talk about some things you're seeing.
Okay. That's a whole other ball of wax for here.
When you mentioned children, did she react a certain way to you?
It was pain. Either, I don't think she knew all of them, but I think at least one of them she did know, like, personally, and that would cause a lot of pain. She reacted with a lot of pain. I'll ask again later.
That's fine. Okay, we're going to leave Marion Hall and venture to the other White House building that Sarah is being pulled to by this other female spirit in the Marion Hall. Apparently she has a message to deliver to a male presence in that space. Okay, we made it into the small white bungalow that's kind of abandoned and just used for storage now.
Mm-hmm. I did lose her. Did I leave her? I left her outside. Okay, I guess she can't come in here. Let's see. I think she wants to move on and she wants to take him with her. Terry Terrence, something like that. What did you do when you were here? Can you show me that again? Like a groundskeeper? Yes, like a groundskeeper. I'm not a great artist, so don't get all hyped up on that. Did you always wear that? Oh no, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Okay. And he's got a good sense of humor. Collars are for those uppity people. Did you wear a hat? Is that a hat? How did you know? Oh, he almost gave me the name and then it disappeared. It was like Lillian or something with an L. Okay, I'll get back to it. So that was the message. Can you leave here? No, he can't.
What's the connection between?
That's what I'm wondering. I've been asking them, but they haven't shared yet, so.
We didn't learn too much from the presence in the small house behind the main house, but Sarah felt there was either a friendship or relationship between the female presence in Marion Hall and this male presence in the White House, and the message that she needed to deliver to him was all that she could really do at this time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're making our way away from the bungalow back to the main house, and Dustin's going to take us through a back door up the stairs to the second story. We filtered back into the first floor of the main house through the side back entrance that puts you directly in front of the service stairwell. The stairwell where Dustin had seen the adolescent girl standing at the top of the stairs. I was curious what Sarah would pick up once we walked through this area and made our way up these stairs. But when we entered, Sarah was pulled away from these stairs and back into the front main part of the house in the foyer by the grand staircase.
All right, I just need to walk around.
Okay, I'll let you go.
I just need to walk around.
We're on the first floor still.
So it's like Lillian, Lily, Lynn, whatever her name was. Let's go with Lillian because it combines both names. Was like house staff. She managed the home. She was paid to manage things, make sure everything was in place. That now makes sense why her demeanor is in that fashion. Everything has to be on point.
Torn between the various names she was picking up from the woman in Marion Hall, Sarah eventually leaned toward Lillian and decided to refer to her by that name from here on out. But the information that she picked up here, along with all she'd said about Lillian upon first arriving at Marion Hall, I couldn't help but make strong connections to the female presence that Cindy described in the same space. Listen to what Cindy described in our initial call.
When she passed, she didn't want to leave because she loved Green Pasture so much. She was the sister-in-law of a friend of the Cook family. And her hangout is Marion Hall. And when you go in that room, you can imagine people in beautiful ball gowns standing. And what an incredible reception room that is. Just full of light and such a beautiful view out into the grounds. I could just see all the parties and the music. And this woman was very much involved in overseeing those events in her day, and she loved that. She just wanted to be constantly a part of that energy and so much enjoyed her time at Maddie's that she just didn't want to leave. She was actually the one that told me about the other souls that were there, and interestingly, they are not all in the same dimension, so they don't communicate with one another. They're kind of in their own isolated spaces of space and time, but somehow she was able to communicate with me, you know, where each person, where their hangout was and where her hangout was, and they were glad to have me. It was kind of a neat experience.
After quietly inspecting the various downstairs rooms on the first floor, Sarah wanted to finally make her way upstairs. We were still in the foyer, so she approached the grand staircase but suddenly froze, her hand outstretched as if it were going to touch the banister, but she'd stopped herself. The next thing Sarah would say would give me goosebumps.
Like someone fell down these stairs. I don't know if it's recent. No, it's not recent. Not unless Dustin remembers that. Then it's way in the past. So someone fell down those stairs and just died. Because it's a trauma, it's going to repeat itself every so often. So, I mean, not all the time. It's kind of lessening a little bit, but it's you will see it. If you're kind of closing up or it's a little bit quiet, maybe you'll kind of catch it, like catch and be like, oh, somebody fell down, and then go there and nobody's there. Or the sound. So the sound of somebody hitting multiple steps is very clear. And so you'll think, oh my God, somebody just fell down. Nothing's there. That's probably what you'll get from off of that stairwell.
This was another part of the night that really stood out to me. There are some things to really look at and scrutinize here, but in the end, I found this as another incredible form of validation on this case. Looking back, Cindy had called out the death of an African-American maid who fell down the service stairs, broke her neck, and died. Right now, we are not at the service stairs. We are at the main grand staircase of the home. But rather than dismiss this right away because the stairwell doesn't match up with Cindy's story, I carefully analyzed all the information I had surrounding both Cindy's stairwell death and Sarah's stairwell death. First off, I toyed with the notion that if Sarah was making things up, anyone could easily assume a psychic call to a haunted location with a large staircase would probably throw out a death falling down the staircase because it could potentially have happened. I mean, it's a staircase. There could have been an accident or a death. If someone were fishing for deaths that could make sense in a home with stairs, this would be a logical guess. If they were not legitimate, they would definitely throw this out with hopes that it would land. But here's the thing. I've been working with Sarah for 3 years now. This incident made me look back at all our previous cases at locations with stairwells. And I realized nearly all of our cases had stairwells. And when I really thought back to them all, it was clear, compared to this gorgeous staircase at Maddie's, the others were far more ominous, eerie, and in most cases, actually treacherous. You have the stairs that led into the dark spider house basement, the unnerving stairway leading up to the third floor attic of the tavern, the uneven limestone stairway that ascended into the cellar of the clay pit. There were more. But looking back at this, Sarah never once at any of these locations mentioned a death attributed to falling downstairs. This was the first. And I made this hard to say this was just luck or a good guess on her part. But if that wasn't enough, hearing what Sarah relayed next pertaining to the spirit who fell down the stairs made it even harder to dismiss.
But they're not, like, for me to... Do I want to say if it's comforting? I don't know if it's comforting or not, but that whoever passed when they fell down the stairs is not here. So it's just a recording of the event. And that's a good thing.
I was now considering this pretty substantial. Sarah hardly calls out what paranormal research call as imprints or residual energy in haunted locations. In some places we've been, like the clay pit, residual energy was significant and Sarah had to point it out. But in most cases, she just notices it, mentions it, moves on quickly. Here, she couldn't stop sensing the fall that this person took, the trauma that was felt on these stairs. However, even though this was strong for Sarah, without prompting, Sarah clearly let us know that this spirit was not present. They had moved on. What she was seeing and feeling was just the act repeating itself, and that the deceased person wasn't suffering through it over and over anymore. I kept my composure, as I always do, and didn't validate anything Sarah was saying in the moment, but my mind went directly back to the conversation I had with Cindy, recalling what she said about the spirit she connected with who fell down the stairs and died.
She was the one that I felt when Dustin and I first walked up the stairs, and I looked to the right and I could feel and see her energy at the bottom of that stairwell. But she's the one that called me when I was driving by. She had been calling since the 1980s, sending out an SOS for someone to come help her get home every single day. And the trees were like her telephone, and she was broadcasting through the trees to anyone that would hear. And I happened to be driving by or guided by that day and called in by the trees, and I came to help her get home.
Cindy had told me over the phone and described in detail the elevation that she had performed for this spirit, and confirmed with me that of all the five spirits she connected with at Maddie's, when she left, there were only four to remain because she had taken the woman that died on the stairs to her new home. But now, in this moment with Sarah, we were finally going to climb the grand staircase and make our way upstairs.
Are we allowed to go up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Kids. There are a lot of kids up here. Footsteps. So you're going to hear footsteps, running. Lots of running. Up here's the kids. It's mostly the kids running up and down. It's just kind of funny because there's a bar upstairs. I just find humor in that. It's just me. That's mostly what you're going to hear. Footsteps. It's going to sound like padding, like small padding. It's the kids. They should have one heavy set of footsteps.
Yeah.
So, and that is the male presence that's directly underneath us. That's him coming up or coming downstairs. So those heavy footsteps that you'll hear are from him. And it'll usually be like kind of if you're closing, everything's kind of winding down, and then it'll... Somebody goes upstairs, just like that gentleman just went down. It's the same. It'll be the same kind of like down the stairs or up the stairs. very heavy footed. But the little pats, those are the kids. The heavier footsteps are the men from downstairs.
We're having yet another validation upon Sarah's first trip upstairs. The first thing that she uttered as she climbed the stairs was kids. Dustin had told us that upstairs, primarily the private dining room, was where the children's handprints formed on the mirrors and windows, and that giggling and laughter can sometimes be heard. Sarah was claiming footsteps, which I hadn't heard as a major report yet. But what's interesting is that there were no claims of children downstairs in any of our research, and Sarah only validated seeing the kids upon arriving upstairs. And to make matters interesting, she was soon drawn to the back narrow hallway that led past the steep service stairs and into the private dining room, one of the most active hotspots for paranormal activity. And Sarah would once again shock us with what she started to pick up next.
Hello, children. Now I'm curious.
This is weird.
Like, they kept something secret in here. I'm trying to figure out what the hell that is. This was like the room they kept stuff in. Something about this room is wrong. I don't know. I can't pin it. Something's wrong. I feel like telling you, like, it's a secret or it's something that you're not supposed to talk about. It happened. Whatever it happened in here. I'm going to pry a little bit, but Lillian left as soon as we walked in here. So let me pry a bit. Dustin's a kid magnet. It's great. I hope you like kids. Do you like kids?
They're fine.
They're fine.
As long as you're somebody else's.
Yeah. Just hang on to Dustin. You're fine. That's one of Dustin's pins. I was wondering why she was following him around, but she's still following him around, so. She looks like this. She has really cute curly hair. She's maybe 4, 5.
Sarah immediately picked up on a 4 or 5 year old little girl. We literally just stepped into the room and she started sketching this little girl, whom she also pointed out seemed to have an affinity for Dustin. Not only did this align with reports from what was seen, felt, and heard in this room, but this is the exact room Cindy said a 4 year old girl had died of a heart condition. It was pretty perplexing to watch all this unfold, and how much of what Sarah was reading upon a cold, blind walkthrough of this space was aligning with accounts from staff and another random psychic that we'd never met. And while Sarah was sitting at the big dining table, sketching this young girl, communicating with her, our team member Alexis suddenly felt something touch him.
It felt like somebody bumped into me.
It's kids.
We're at, like, what level?
Like, on my butt.
It's the kids. Okay. So, yeah, of course I can do better than that. Can you show me the dress that you like? Sure. Okay. His name is Dusted. Can you tell me your name? I don't know how often he comes up here. Want me to ask? Dustin, how often do you come up here?
Like every day.
Oh, I'm sorry. Should I tell him to do that every now and then? Okay, sure.
Say hello.
Yes. She's like, just say hello, and candy would be great, right? Just kind of leave one out for you. Where do you want it? Okay, just one. No problem. Thank you, Amy.
That's Amy.
Amy.
4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
Is she drawn to Dustin?
She just likes Dustin, yeah. I'm trying to figure out if she's related to the other boys that are running around here. Are they like... No, she's not. She says she's older, but those boys are bigger. What's older? Yes, that was the guy from downstairs. Do you know it in here? I don't see him in here. Okay, she's referencing the guy that went for the bathrooms. Like in here. Like this is his spot besides the other. How are you older? She was here first. Oh, okay.
Oh, and like when she...
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Like that span of time.
That span of time, she's older. Okay, that makes sense.
She was here before, like in the older time period.
She passed first. Uh-huh. Okay, so she's... So then... Lillian. That makes sense. Okay, so she's connected to Lillian.
Does she show you anything about her, like, passing at all?
It's not her... Or she was sick. She's just... She was really, really sick. It's like she's showing me, like, from one day to the next, she was playing outside, everything was fine, and then she didn't feel well, and then she had to lay down. Like, she's almost telling me, like, I was forced to lay down, and then she just got sick. It's like she, like, had fever. All I'm getting is just, like, I'm just really sick. Lillian was, like, not a parent, but I guess just she was always with her, so, but that's where the pain kind of comes in. That makes sense. But she was the daughter of the people that owned the home at the time.
From my conversation with Cindy, she claimed that the 4-year-old girl residing in this private dining room had an undiagnosed congenital heart disease and passed away suddenly. Sarah is picking up on a possible fever or illness, but I wasn't discounting that this could possibly be the same girl that both psychics were seeing and that Dustin and many other staff members feel in this space. But Sarah was being pulled to the storage closet toward the back of the private dining room now. It now serves as a small office and liquor storage, and Dustin had taken us inside for our first visit. Now, Sarah was claiming this is where the man from the downstairs bathrooms seemed to hide or hang out.
Can you... Okay, yeah. Dustin, unlock the door. Are we going in there? Yeah? Yeah. You're not scared?
No, he... Yeah, Dustin's... You're not scared? Dustin took us in here.
All right.
Is there a light in here, Dustin?
Yeah, right on the left before switch.
There we go.
The secret. Now I want to know what the secret is. What is the secret?
Who's telling you that?
It's like I can just... It's just weird. Don't be poking at me. I don't like it.
Okay.
It's just really weird. But it is connected to that guy.
Still.
Yeah. Really weird.
I found it odd how the child spirit Amy had told Sarah that the man from downstairs was up in this private dining room space with us. From everything I'd heard so far pertaining to this room, it was only the childlike presences that had been felt. But when Sarah was lured into the back storage room, she felt the man's presence from downstairs hiding in there somewhere. Sarah was also being poked and prodded, and she didn't like it. But she couldn't find this male presence who seemed to be hiding, so we decided to move on. We moved out of the private dining room area, past the hallway, and up the small stairs onto the second level above the front main part of the house. Sarah was immediately pulled into the upstairs bar, where Dustin had reported being tapped on his shoulder sitting at the stool, and psychic Cindy claimed there was a spirit of a man who died in World War I, who she believes was a friend of the Falks, and seemed to want to return to this space in death.
Do you not like it? Do you not like the changes? Okay. So if you see him, it's a you can see him sitting. I'm getting the feeling like he owned this joint. To say it in the way that I'm accustomed to hearing it in my head. This was his space. He has an interesting short hair, very clean. But this was his space. This is where he liked to be. It's changed, and I don't know if he's happy with that. He says it's okay, but he'd wished that he had been told, somebody had told him before the renovations were done. He doesn't necessarily try to go out of his way to make people feel uncomfortable when they come in here. It just happens. But if he's not in the mood, he's not in the mood, and you'll know. You won't want to come in here. Or you'll feel eerie coming in, and I make him a little uncomfortable. Do you have messaging? Oh, yes. Ooh, I shouldn't even have asked that question. So, Dustin, just if you change anything else, can you please give him a heads up? He always wants to know if there's any changes that are going to happen. There's a certain time of day. Really? I'm going to make Dustin test that theory, okay? So there's a certain time of day that you can come in here and clearly see him. So it'll be right at, like, maybe in the afternoon between 5:30 going to 6. If you're setting something up, like, over here, you should be able to clearly see him in this room. Like, see him, like, you and me.
Not an apparition.
He's going to look like there is a physical butt sitting in a chair. And it's really weird that he's saying that. He goes, he wants to introduce himself to you. So just be, like, maybe in the area around that time if you can. Pick a day. The feeling I'm getting is kind of like, almost like a gentleman-to-gentleman meet and greet, right? And he's saying, come during that time, and we'll kind of, like, settle everything. And whatever he's doing, he's trying to let you know, yes, this is his space, but he's kind of still wanting to share it with you. It's really weird. And he doesn't really like people coming in here. And he understands, like, he understands that things have changed and people come in here and, you know, it is, he just doesn't really like it yet. And he just feels like if he can make that connection, I guess, it'll make it a little bit easier for him. Like, he can trust that you'll tell him if you're going to do something different or warn him when people are going to be in here. He kind of, like, needs that heads up.
This Not guy, right does now. He get a, give you a sense of, like, what time period, what kind of person he was?
Or? Time period is almost, like, early 1900s, maybe. I don't want to say 18, maybe late 1800s to early 1900s. I don't know. It's really hard because he's wearing a, almost like a suit or a... He's very formally dressed.
Once again, Sarah is picking up on a spirit in another area where Cindy found a presence. Staff have had experiences, and what's more is Sarah is describing a spirit that connects in many ways with Cindy's readings. A male presence from the early 1900s who seems to claim this space and makes his presence known. One other thing I made a mental note of was how Sarah described the man's hair. She said, short hair, very clean. And as most people know, military cuts are always short and clean. But in World War I, a type of haircut called the regulation cut was very popular. It's where the sides and back are sharply tapered and the top is left longer so it can be parted on the side and very cleanly combed over.
Can I get any? Not today. All right, that's all right. When you're comfortable, you can just throw the name out there. I know you don't know me. I know. I understand. I get it. We'll see. It's more for we're more focused on Dustin right now. Okay. That's two out of the three pins. Okay.
Amy and this guy.
So that's two. The third one we're gonna have to go back where we started.
Okay.
Sarah mentioned three pins that she wanted to note throughout this case for Dustin. I didn't know what that meant when she spoke it, but it appeared she had an indication that there were three messages specifically for Dustin that she was supposed to find and deliver tonight. First was the four-year-old girl wanting Dustin to know to say hi and leave her candy. Second was the man in the upstairs bar, where Dustin had felt a presence and been touched before. The man at the bar felt this space was his, seemed to know that Dustin was now running this space and managing it, and just wanted to share with Dustin some of what Sarah mentioned to him, sort of an exchanging of hands of sort. What I found to be of importance with these two pins were how they were significant in regards to Dustin, his personal experiences, and his time spent at Maddie's. Dustin's two favorite spots and places he frequents while working here or taking breaks are the private dining room and the upstairs bar, and in these areas he's felt both presences. The little girl was something Dustin clearly pointed out to me on our first visit, and you could sense that the way he spoke of her, that he was fond of her, and had a unique connection to the child's presence. It was really incredible to hear Sarah call out the young girl in the exact space that Dustin felt her, and even called out that she really liked Dustin, clung to him for protection, and wanted to deliver these couple of requests. Secondly, the info Sarah relayed to Dustin from the man in the bar was a second pin for him. And ironically, Dustin also felt a presence in this space, and when describing the incident when he was tapped on the shoulder, he described it as not aggressive, but like a person who simply was letting him know, hey, I'm here, you're in my seat. This male presence who seems to claim the upstairs bar that Dustin now mostly works and manages, just wanted to inform him that he wanted his presence to be acknowledged and to give him a heads up when things were coming up, like parties or renovations or changes. The fact that Sarah was finding presences that matched much of the reports and what Cindy had detailed was really impressive. But then seeing these very specific requests for Dustin in the two areas he is closely tied to and spends almost all his time at in Maddie's was undeniably noteworthy. But the night was coming to an end, and Sarah wanted to return to Marion Hall, absorb all that she had experienced tonight, and give us a final recap.
So I'm just going to call her Lily, and just to combine the two names that I've got, because I'm not sure. It's like either, you know, Lily, Lillian, Lynn. I don't know. At coming in, she just kind of let me, like she allowed me to come in. But you would see her, if people catch her in photos or catch her kind of like a glimpse in, it's going to be her kind of just walking through. She's making sure everything is okay. She's, you know, She has a very strong presence, and she's just making sure everything's running the way that it needs to run. She's tempered moods for different things that have gone on, like different events that you've had that maybe have got a little rowdy, or, you know, she's the one who will come in and kind of temper the mood down so it doesn't get out of hand, right? She's making sure that everything is good. In talking with her, it's kind of like, I can't show you my full form. So that's, I think she's not going to be here a lot longer, because I'm only getting like partial of a face or partial of her body. It's almost like she wants to manifest, but it's like, she's like, no, I don't feel like it. You know, I'm just going to give you a little bit so you know that I'm here. Mostly for her, the messaging was to go back out to the, to that outdoor house for Terry or Terrence. She just really wants him to, she doesn't want to go unless he's going with her is kind of what I'm getting. But right now he's not able to leave that part of the property. How they're connected, I don't know. I can suspect that either they were in a relationship or they just were really, really close. I don't know, you know, how that worked. They weren't really very sharing. It was mostly just about each other, about here, I'm going to give you this message now. Just relay it. I was just relaying.
I know you talked about some things in here, and the one thing that was mentioned was the woman presence. Just connect anything, if there's any sort of dots to connect there, just so we know what might have connected.
We kind of refer to her as the caretaker. She's kind of in charge. You know, she definitely likes the parties, enjoys the trees. I mean, mostly the windows. It's kind of the energy that gets thrown off.
This bathroom person...
our bathroom
there's
person.
Some connections there that I'll kind of have you connect
our
ducks
bathroom
there.
Person I don't know, he's very flighty, but when you're talking to him, or when I was trying to talk to him, his images and like the wording was not in the right order or a little confused, like he would add extra things that didn't make sense. I've experienced it with people who had mental illnesses and have passed, where their thoughts are not cohesive. I have to really kind of work with it. But the interesting thing is that his presence is upstairs in that back,
the office,
the short office room.
Office, yeah.
So he's there, like it's kind of there, but the feeling when you walk in there is kind of like, shh, don't say anything. Like it's a really weird, I don't know. It's like a really weird feeling, like almost like A, I shouldn't be in there, and B, we don't talk about it. Like just a weird feeling.
That's weird. You had shown me that bathroom and talked about how the women felt uncomfortable.
Just a feeling of being watched, you know? I mean, just an uneasy feeling, you know, just being in there.
And we did talk a little about hidden spaces and things like that, because it seems like this house, Alexis got a feeling that he felt there was more rooms than you can actually find.
You can navigate more through the house. Like, I can see that it's there, but I don't know how to get in there. With this particular person is that he knows how to do that, so that he keeps disappearing in, like he keeps disappearing in weird angles, like in the house. So when as we were walking through, he was following along, but he was kind of like ducking into walls or moving into things. And I was like, it's kind of weird. Why is he doing that? But it's because I think he knows how to navigate through the home better than you guys do. Yeah.
Maybe that's the secret. Maybe that's it's the hidden compartments that we don't really know exist, if they are real.
They don't even have to be material. Yeah. You know what I mean? Maybe it's just like a channel.
It's a, yeah, what, he, I mean? What it used to be, yeah. And now it's covered by certain walls or doorways. Yeah.
What got me was, though, the guy at the bar, when I mentioned it, or we even started talking about it, he was, like, he went to that, no. Like, that was a definite do not cross that line, talking to me about him.
So we still have the little girl, though.
Amy.
The four-year-old girl. You did mention in that room there is a lot of...
Yeah, she says hello frequently. You know, there's definitely like a little, you know, child. I mean, I have a sister who's 16 years younger. I have nieces and nephews, and I've been around. I know when there's like children there.
As we were gathering our things, wrapping up, I decided to grab Dustin just to see if he could share his personal feelings about the evening. Apologies in advance about the audio here. Sarah was having a conversation with someone in the background, but I still felt it was important to share Dustin's final thoughts here.
Oh, it's very interesting to see the correlation from what the experiences from people, from myself. It's the correlations between what an unprovoked person felt coming in here, just, you know, walking up off the street and hanging out in the little room for 3 hours and coming up with all this information, and how it's very congruent to, you know, a lot of the stuff that Sarah said. Specifically, you know, I definitely feel, you know, a relationship with the little girl up in the thing. You know, I feel that, you know, almost every day. I walk in that room all the time, you know, and it's very comforting to know that something that's outside the realm of what we exist in still knows that we exist and still needs us in some way. When, you know, that's a very peaceful thought. It's very interesting to hear about, you know, what females specifically feel in that area, in that restroom, because she picked up on that pretty quickly. And the Lillian, who she's calling Lillian, I'm not sure of a name, but who watches over, you know, I mean, look forward to more research, and hopefully this isn't the end. I mean, hopefully this is just like another step into figuring out, you know, what's between the sky and earth, man, you know, so.
At the end of our visit with Sarah, I was honestly quite impressed with the connections that she'd made. I knew my job wasn't over, though, and that I'd have my work cut out for me trying to connect any of these incredible psychic validations, now had by both Cindy and Sarah, to any factual historical data. But I already had my father working on this research, and was eager to see if any of the information he found would corroborate any of these findings or psychic readings. However, by the end of the night, there was one thing still hanging over my head. Even though Sarah actually found four spirits that eerily aligned with Cindy's findings, the one spirit I was most excited for Sarah to shed light on never appeared to her. The whole night, Sarah never once reported an adolescent girl, the one that Cindy detailed in her readings and Dustin and Joel separately witnessed as a full-bodied apparition. I even decided to inform Sarah of these incidents at the end of the night so we could actually go looking for her, but Sarah came back saying she simply didn't see her. In all, it was a great night of investigating, and I had a lot to pursue in my research. Following this short break, I'll dive into the far-reaching history of this property, and amidst my searching for clues, I'll be contacted by additional staff, patrons, and even a family member who once grew up and lived in this home for nearly 20 years. Stay tuned. A lot of people ask me, how can we support the Night Owl podcast? Well, there are two ways, actually, and what's cool is both ways actually benefit you when you do. Firstly, if you love the show, the best way you can support us is by becoming a Night Owl patron through Patreon. Patreon is a place where listeners and fans of the show gain access to exclusive extras by choosing a dedicated monthly pledge to donate to our show and keep it going. How Patreon works is you set up a small, repeating donation of your choosing. It can even be as little as a dollar a month. It's basically a tip you're giving us for each episode. And these contributions will help cover the costs of things like web hosting, editing, software, equipment, travel, and all the little things it takes to make the show happen. Patreon is safe, secure, and easy to use. You decide how much you want to give per month, and if needed, you can easily cancel or suspend your contribution hassle-free. And in return for your support, we offer you exclusive access to deleted audio segments, follow-up interviews, video walkthroughs of locations we've investigated, my personal video diaries where I share secrets and personal thoughts about each episode. And patrons also get early access to ghost tour and event tickets, as well as a discount code for our merch. So go check out patreon.com/thenightowlpodcast, and I hope you can join our Night Owl patron community. That's patreon.com/thenightowlpodcast. Another way you can support us is by grabbing some Night Owl merchandise. We've relaunched our online store and updated it with some new items. Our store is filled with some really cool merch that true fans of the show like you can order and wear, proudly displaying to others what podcast you love and support. We have tanks, tees, hoodies, tote bags, stickers, and my personal favorite item, enamel pins. We even have some fun glow-in-the-dark options for my true Night Owls out there, who prefer the dark like I do. So go check out our online store at thenightowlpodcast.com. Grab yourself some kick-ass merch and support our indie show. All of our screen printer materials, tees, tanks, totes, hoodies, etc. are created by our incredible sponsor, Oh Boy Print Shop, a local family-owned print shop that's been supporting our show since our early beginnings. I was nervous about taking the leap financially on my first run of t-shirts, so I looked around at several shops before making my decision. Oh Boy Print Shop was hands down the standout shop for me. They addressed every concern and question I had personally with expert advice. They even helped me adjust my logo to work well for printing and showed me examples of the shirts in person so I could put my hands on them and even try them on. Their awesome customer service and professionalism made me more comfortable with the decision to go for it and print my first run of shirts. I sold out within a month and have been an Oh Boy Print Shop customer ever since. If you're looking to create some brand tees or get your name out there with custom screen printed materials, if you work with Oh Boy Print Shop, mention the Night Owl podcast and you'll get $50 off your first order. So what are you waiting for? Visit ohboyprintshop.com. That's OHBOY printshop.com. So, following our visit to Maddie's with Sarah on February 1st, it was hard to deny the incredible correlations between the reported paranormal experiences by staff at Maddie's, what visiting psychic Cindy found in detail long before we even got involved, and Sarah's recent findings. But as usual, I like to take these cases as far as I possibly can in hopes of finding as much validation as possible. So I dove into the research my father had collected and began searching for clues, gaining a very clear understanding of the history of this location. Here's a snapshot of what we could find. This property was home to only wild game such as deer and turkey and the nomadic Native Americans until the early 1700s. At that time, the Spanish monks attempted to establish missions here, but were soon forced out by hostile Native American attacks. In 1834, this area was part of the Isaac Decker land grant issued to him by Mexico through Empresario Ben Milam. Decker received 1 league, that's 640 acres, for farming and ranching, but he too left the area rather quickly because of hostile Native American attacks. James Edward Bolden purchased the property in 1840. Bolden was extremely loyal to the Confederacy during the Civil War and actually received a pardon after the war from President Andrew Johnson for his treasonous acts against the U.S. during the war. In 1893, Dr. Eugene Wallace Herndon purchased 50 acres from the Bolden heirs and in 1895 built the beautiful Texas-style farmhouse with Victorian architecture that still stands on the property today. The house was constructed from first-growth cypress, maple, and oak timbers that were hauled here by oxcart from Louisiana. E.W. Herndon was a physician, a minister, and an avid poultry producer. He was also at one time vice president of the Travis Country Poultry Association, and this property was called the Cedar Ridge Chicken Ranch. According to the records we could find, Herndon lived here with his wife Anna and his son Robert until his death here at the home in 1904. In 1910, the city of Austin opened the Congress Avenue Bridge, fostering development south of the Colorado River and allowing for development of the Travis Heights area and the beginning of South Austin. During that time period, the house and property were owned by Judge W.W. Burnett from 1911 to 1913. On July 1913, Burnett's 17-year-old son died at the property from typhoid fever. Thereafter, Judge Burnett retired and moved to his ranch near Dripping Springs. In 1915, Judge Henry Falk moved his family here. His wife, Maddie, was originally against the move, but Judge Falk prevailed because he, quote, wanted to be able to have more than one milk cow, end quote. Henry Falk was a one-time county attorney, a publisher of the Austin Tribune, and practiced law for much of his lifetime. This area was one of Austin's first integrated neighborhoods, and Judge Falk became a champion to the black population. He firmly believed that everyone should be able to have fair representation in courts, no matter your race, and he did all he could, much of it pro bono, to help his neighbors. His funeral in 1939 brought the biggest turnout Austin had ever seen from the black community. Interestingly, the Wilk Manor Funeral Home allowed viewing until 2 p.m. Then the body was moved to Fred Allen Memorial Methodist to allow both races to pay their respects. During World War II, all the Falk women and their children lived at this home while their men were at war. As many as 25 to 35 people were reported to have lived here, but the war years fell between the federal census reports in 1940 and 1950, so these numbers could not be verified. One of the Falk children, John Henry Falk, went on to become a renowned author, humorist, folklorist, and radio and TV personality. After Mr. Falk's death, Mary Falk Cook and her husband Chester moved in with Maddie. In 1946, Maddie gave the home to Mary and Chester, supposedly because Mary, quote, had the most children. Mary began catering and hosting parties to earn extra income. Her reputation as a good cook and hostess eventually led to the opening of a formal restaurant, Green Pastures. For the next 25 years, Austin's oldest families, politicians, celebrities, visiting ambassadors, and other dignitaries dined at Green Pastures. Following in her father's footsteps, Green Pastures was open to people of all races and religions from the moment it first opened its doors to the public in 1946. Even though desegregation did not formally occur until after the Civil Rights Act in 1964. In 1965, a fire destroyed the second story of this historic home, but Mary and Chester restored the home to its original beauty and continued to operate the restaurant until they passed the torch to their oldest son, Ken Cook, in 1969. Ken and his business partner, Lee Buslett, operated Green Pastures until the property was sold in 2015 to Greg Porter, Jeff Trigger, and other investors. The home was remodeled and the restaurant was reopened in 2017. The restaurant was renamed Maddie's after one of its original owners, Maddie Falk. My father did an extensive month-long dive into research on this case, as is evident probably in what you just heard, diving into family trees, census records, property records, news articles, you name it. However, in the end, although we had a very detailed understanding of the history of this property and the many families that once lived here, there wasn't a single thing that connected with the paranormal reports. Not a single one seemed to line up with the presences that we now believe haunted this historic home. Now, that doesn't discount everyone's sightings or the incredible validations made by Sarah in regards to the existing reports, but I always hope to validate these accounts with history. And in this case, it just wasn't possible. But I wasn't finished with research on this case quite yet. Following the release of part one of this series last month, I now had people finally coming forward offering to share stories with me about Maddie's. People who had once worked or dined there and had an experience. But most exciting to me was that I was able to track down an actual family member of the Falk Cook family who actually grew up in this incredible historic home. Her name was Martha Cook Ward, and she was the daughter of Mary Cook. I was dying to get on a call with Martha to see if possibly she could shed any new light on the mysterious happenings at Maddie's.
So my name is Martha Cook Ward, and I'm sixth generation Austinite and a resident of the property known at one point as Green Pastures. So I was born in 1948. I lived there from 48 to 68. So I grew up there, and it was about that time that my parents, primarily my mother, Mary Falk Cook, had started a business. I was the seventh child. And they needed income. And my mother was a very clever and remarkable woman and loved to entertain and did it well. And so they opened a catering and restaurant business there. And it kind of fluctuated on and off whether the restaurant was operative or not, because it was a whole new lifestyle business model for them and not one that they knew real well, so they had to make it up. For a very long time, there was only one bathroom in the house. And during World War II, which I was born just after that, there were all the adult women who, with children, moved there with their children because their husbands were away at war. And that was, my grandmother ran a huge garden and chickens and had a couple of cows to milk and so on and so forth. So it became where the women and children lived during that period of time. So growing up, remember, there were seven children. So the boys lived in that room, which is now a private dining room. I had three brothers. They lived in that room above and off of those back stairs. And then from that rear of the house, there is a small hallway that then comes to the top of the front stairs. At a level that we call the landing. So you come up those front steps, there's a level floor, and then two staircases, short staircases, go up each side to the second floor. So that was our bedroom. My parents' room was in the southeast corner. My sister Karen, who had been severely burned, she had a bedroom of her own, and it was in the southwest corner of that part of the structure. And then there were three other girls, and we shared the two bedrooms on the north side of that hallway. We always, I can remember this growing up, always had people who came to stay, often for extended period of time, who were not family. When my grandfather and grandmother lived there, he was a lawyer, and he was the kind of lawyer that if he had a client, the client was having some kind of personal problem, he would invite them out to the house. He'd say, why don't you come out to the house for a couple of days, and we'll talk about your situation, and, you know, you can have some really good buttermilk and cornbread, and it'll just get you right as rain. So oftentimes he counseled his clients out of needing whatever suit that they thought that they would want to file. That was just really typical of my grandfather. My grandfather came from tenant farmers. He was very intelligent. He was invited by some cousins to come to Austin to go to school, which was exceptional for their family. He went to the University of Texas, and he got a law degree, and he practiced law. I think it came from my grandfather's sense of equity of all people, not so much equality, but actual equity, that everybody deserved to have what they needed to move up in the world. So just to tell you how it carried forward, two things. One, when my parents opened the restaurant, so that was in the late 40s, it was open to all races, all denominations. So Jews who were discriminated against, persons of color who were discriminated against, were all welcome at Green Pastures. This was exceptional. Clearly, they did not come at the same time. That just didn't happen. But they did each have events there over the decades that celebrated who they were. All of the family members had personalities and a real sense of justice and righting of injustice.
In our investigation, two of our members were like, it feels like there's faces that I can't see that things travel and move through. Ever in your time there, were there like hidden crawl spaces or places to hide out or travel through?
The only place that I can remember was under those back stairs. There was a closet. And from my perspective as a child, it was a place that led to some place, but it was not a place that I could get to. Now, that was just from the understanding of a child. You know, I think that to some degree, the building has been reconformed under the renovation, restoration. So, like, for instance, under those stairs in the front hall, there are all these restrooms. We had a men's restroom and a women's restroom that my mother had added because, like I said, originally the house only had one restroom for the entire family. It's interesting to think about how rural and simple at one level, or maybe not simple, maybe complicated depending on your perspective, living out there was. That side of the river was considered to be where cedar choppers lived, and these were people who were the lowest of the white community economically. And they did indeed chop cedar. That was their work in the world. And they built fences and, you know, it was used for outbuildings and different things like that. But that old area south of the river was not at all developed at that time. There's a plaque on the front of the house that tells you about the Herndon family father who built that house. And my understanding is that they did not live there, or they lived there a very short period of time because their only child died, and I don't know if it was a fever of the time or how, but they ended up selling it to my grandfather.
Based on historical research, all the records for the Herndon family show them only having one child, and it was a son. But the Burnetts, the second family to inhabit this home, actually lost a child to typhoid fever. But it was also a son. His name was Elwood, and he was 17 years old. However, looking back, Cindy had mentioned the adolescent girl, the one that Sarah never felt, admitted that she was an adopted daughter of the Herndons. Another note to make is that the census was only recorded every 10 years or so back in that time, so it's difficult to say that the census records are actually accurate because they skipped many years. And who's to say if the Herndons, or possibly even the Burnett family, might have had an adolescent girl who died of a fever in their house.
Some of the common things are upstairs, that room that I believe you said your brothers slept in and lived in, above like once you go up those back narrow stairs, you hang a right and there's like a little room back there. It's now the private dining room. They sense a small 4 to 5 year old little girl. Both psychics picked this girl up. There was some interesting energy about her. They believe that she was prone to illness and blacking out often. And she eventually died of what one of them believed was congenital heart failure. I don't know if any of this rings a bell. I'm just curious to know if there was a little girl that might have been sick or might have passed away the time that you might have known of that house.
That's such an interesting idea. No, I'm sorry to say I don't know of that kind of situation. And I feel like because my aunts and uncles, you know, they were all here, and we did have an aunt. No, she would have been an aunt to my mother, who was a nurse and came and lived at the house for a while. And I think probably helped maybe after a birth or something else like that helped out. Back in the day, people just came and stayed, either family members or maybe sometimes perfect strangers who would just come and stay at the house. And there was always circumstances that underlied why they stayed there, but we always were very happy to have them. I don't remember anybody that we couldn't wait to have them leave. They were there and they were part of the family. I think that they're potentially could have been some cousin or something, but I don't remember anybody ever talking about someone dying, a child in particular, dying there.
There's a couple other little things I would like to point out and see if anything connects. They did not call her like a servant or nothing like that, but they mentioned an African-American woman seemed to apparently be working and helping out around the house, and she fell down a flight of stairs. Not sure if it was the main one or the smaller one, but she actually passed away. And what's crazy is that both psychics got that without ever talking to each other or knowing each other. That's incredible, but I don't know if I can validate that. I don't know if you know of anybody that might have been in the family or before your time or your mother's time.
I'm pretty confident that would have been before my grandfather's time at that house. I feel confident it would have been a prior family. From my knowledge, which I keep wanting to say, I feel is so limited. I wish it was greater for your effort because I find your effort fascinating and I'd love to validate it. I feel like there was something around the Herndon family that there were losses there. Now, whether it was the loss of this woman's life, I understood they lost a girl child. I thought to an illness like whatever fever was popular at the time, scarlet fever perhaps. But I'm sure they would have had help because people of that class always had help back in the day.
I went on to point out the spirit of Lillian, as well as the young men from the bathroom, the upstairs bar male presence, and even Terry or Terrence from the small White House. Martha was so kind to entertain me and listen to me share these stories, but in the end, she sadly could not think of any direct connections with any of these supposed spirits. But Martha did have one final thing to say, which actually surprised me and brought up a very interesting theory that I hadn't considered yet.
What I think is really interesting, Stephen, is that it's almost like the exchange of hands of the house from our family seems to have opened up a lot of, let's just say, vortexes. We didn't have any awareness of this. At least I am not aware of anybody in the family having any of this awareness about these spirits. So I find it just fascinating. But I'm just thinking all that opening up that they did of that building and research that they did on that building in order to comply with the historical requirements for restoration and renovation, no doubt unearthed some things that we may not have even been aware of.
Despite not having any real hits or answers to the paranormal experiences at Maddie's through this conversation, I was just honored to have a chance to gain some insight behind what life was really like at Green Pastures from someone who actually lived there. It was a place truly representing an important culture that the Falks clearly cultivated in this city, and it was a pleasure talking with Martha. But I wasn't going to let what Martha said to me at the close of our conversation fall on deaf ears. To be honest, I was a little embarrassed that a sweet elderly woman without much belief in the paranormal could throw out a theory that I completely overlooked. That perhaps the ghosts haunting Maddie's haven't been roaming the halls there for half a century, or even decades. Perhaps we're coming into a case that falls into a new category for me and my team. A fairly new developing haunting. As my mind thought about Martha's last words and the theory about recent renovations opening up something in that historic home, it got me thinking about haunted places like the ones we feature on our show, the ghost stories we capture and discover at these places, and how, perhaps, they are all new hauntings. And what we're doing is documenting these stories so that years from now, it's commonplace to know these places are haunted. I was so fascinated with all these new thoughts that I remembered hearing about a local university professor teaching a folklore class who was actually using our show in her teachings. Before moving on, I wanted to connect with this professor, introduce myself, and just gain knowledge on folklore and the unique thought of how these stories all begin.
So my name is Dr. Rachel Gonzalez-Martin, and I am a professor of Latino Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. I am not a born native Texan. I'm originally from California. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I grew up in a household that was firm believers in the supernatural, and my grandmother read cards and could see things. And so I've always grown up with an interest in the paranormal. Professionally, though, I have a doctorate in folklore. And so folklore is the study of creativity in everyday life. And part of that is understanding different storytelling genres. And the genres that I love the most tend to be supernatural narratives or narratives of the paranormal or of the absurd. I haven't necessarily professionally published much on the supernatural because the supernatural is really not highly valued in academia, but I write about the material and cultural arts of U.S. Latinos and Latinas, particularly women of color. And this summer, I'm actually going to be teaching a course called Latinx Tales, where I'm talking about the story specifically of what I'm calling haunted women. And haunted women are common in Latino folklore, particularly narrative folklore. If anyone is familiar with La Llorona, or the tale of Dancing with the Devil, or stories of creatures like the Lechuza, these are all narrative forms of folklore that persist in our communities, and they tell us something about who we are and where we came from, about how we feel about things that we don't understand. But they also, you know, they nod to these understandings of how we relate to our world as unknowable in some ways. But what you have with Maddie's is the start of a legend trope. It's the start of a story that will continue likely for generations as it is relevant. Folklore continues and it persists in communities when people can find it to be relevant. So if apparitions continue, if people can sensitive continue to feel spirits and experiences at this place and regular people can see these specters while they're having dinner or brunch or in their wedding reception, people will continue to tell that story. And then that story continues and persists and ownership changes, as staffing changes, as those telling the stories change, then what you have is the ability for the story to sort of get solidified in popular belief. And so now you have this restaurant that people know it first as, oh, it's that place where five spirits live in these different places and everyone knows it's haunted. And so the Night Owl as a podcast, the process of going out and investigating and actually taking these claims seriously and trying to take an organized view of what's going on and an open mind means that these stories have a chance to surface. And as we think about, as a scholar of race and cultural practice, understanding how voices get marginalized, I'm often thinking about race and class, but also areas of belief. Folks who believe and are very adamant about the existence of the paranormal or existence of ghosts or spirits are often socially marginalized. If you believe in ghosts, I'm not going to believe anything else you say because I don't believe you have all your wits about you. So the idea of creating a space for people to have and share belief is extremely crucial to creating sort of levels of community trust and community building. So it's not just about an individual story, but it's the idea that these stories can thrive and they're given an opportunity to thrive outside of, let's say, the smallest circles or outside of an individual's experience. But when you can build a community around it, all of a sudden it depersonalizes to where you're experiencing something real, but it's not necessarily attacking you. It's something that exists in the world, right? And that can be really liberating for people, particularly if they've had experiences their whole lives. To say we as opposed to I has a huge impact on people's personal and mental well-being.
Ironically, following our conversation, as Dr. Gonzalez-Martin had predicted, the stories surrounding Maddie's would continue to grow, both with patrons and staff continuing to have experiences and sharing them amongst each other. I would actually hear from three more people tied to Maddie's, both past and present, who are coming forward now with their own personal experiences to share with me. And first, in a funny full circle sort of way, I found myself following yet another lead that came to me through Facebook. Elaine Ireland is a veteran working psychic here in Austin that I've had the pleasure of meeting through this show. She was featured in a campfire episode about a haunted school here in Austin. And since that show, Elaine has truly become a great resource and friend for the Night Owl team. When I released part one of this Maddie's series, I posted a few images to promote the episode on social media. When Elaine saw it, she immediately commented on my post. Here's what she wrote. I used to work there. Hope that you go to visit with and see the lady that hung out in the back door of the kitchen and the young man that didn't like the way the Cook family created a wine bar upstairs. That was a long time ago. Are the peacocks still roaming the property? I loved every inch of that place. Looking forward to this show. Already knowing Elaine's ability as a psychic and now hearing that she used to work at Green Pastures, I had to get her on the phone.
It was Green Pastures when I was there. Always worked on weekends. A lot of times these folks were in that building by themselves. The bakery people and then the crew that came in to do the prepping for all of the rest of the foods, the fresh foods. Those people were in that building by themselves a lot. And I picked up the lady by the back door early on when I went to work there. When I would go back to the kitchen, I would see her standing there. So finally, I asked one of the guys that had been there for God only knows how long. It wouldn't surprise me if he was there when Mrs. Cook was cooking back there. But everybody knew he was the oldest member of that staff. And I finally stopped and said, do you ever talk to the lady that stands by the door? And he said, you can see her? And I said, I feel her. And he said that, yes, he could feel her watching him cook. He said, she never comes in. I only see her standing there, like she wants to come in, but she doesn't. And I said, does she talk to you? And he said, sometimes I think she does. So I talked back. Everybody knew about her and the kids. We called them the hanging kids. The kids that kind of like kids will sit bull-legged, where you sit on the floor and you have your legs crossed like you're going to play jacks on the floor. It was like they were hanging in the air like that. But there were three of them, two boys and a girl. And everybody knew about them, the hanging kids. They were always up there. And you'd walk up the stairs and you'd hear them giggle. And I was there the summer that they finished. They were doing the reconstructing and actually opened up the wine bar. We had heard all kinds of steps going up and down, of course, because the workers were there. Except when serving was going on. They weren't supposed to be there when people were being served. And then when they weren't there, we'd still hear steps. Well, supposedly, there was also a young man that at one time either lived up there or lived with family and helped or something. And he died tragically. I don't remember how, but he was very young. He was in his 20s when he died. And he just stuck around. And it was like he would walk up and down the stairs, up and down the stairs, up and down the stairs. You get in that house if you work there for a while or if you're come and go for any reason on a regular basis. You would get to where you would hear sounds and then you didn't hear them anymore. They just became part of the environment. The lady at the back door, I saw her repeatedly and she was always looking in. And in her time, it would have been considered very unladylike to lean against the door jamb. And of course, she had a longer dress on, not a long dress, but a longer dress. I would say 1940s, maybe a little before. Her hair was pulled up. I couldn't see the back of it. I never saw her backside, but she looked neat. She didn't look messy. She didn't look like somebody who worked there. She looked neat, but always just leaning against the door. Everybody, after a while, it was no big deal to see these energy. Everybody that worked there knew that there were spirits there.
One thing that psychic who came and did the writing, she never mentioned any little boys. She mentioned little girls. Sarah saw two boys and a girl. So that's really interesting.
There were some really interesting things to note here just with this first part of Elaine's call with me. She pointed out a lady downstairs, two young boys and a little girl upstairs, and then there was this young man who died tragically, according to her, who roamed between downstairs and upstairs. I couldn't help but think back to the creepy young man from the bathroom who also seemed to hide in the private dining room storage closet that Sarah saw.
You know, the young man that died tragically, you might even be able to ask the Cook family about him. What I picked up from him was that he was either a family member or close to the family in some way, and there was a specific reason for him being there. And probably worked. Maybe they put him to work, you know, keep him busy. But there was a reason why he needed to stay there. And then he died tragically. But there was a specific reason for him being with the Cook family or in that house. When I picked him up, I'm going, he's kind of out of place.
Was there anything odd about him, like strange? Did you get any of that, or you just felt the tragic death?
No, I felt like something was off with him. Either he was sick or he was mentally incompetent or something was not okay with him. There was a room up there that might have been a bedroom at one time. It was a fairly small room. Don't know if they're still using it now or not or what they've done with it, but it was always locked. And I think it was locked because management was afraid that maybe a kid would wander away from their party or something, or some adult would get curious. But it always felt like I didn't belong. I shouldn't be up there. And I never felt comfortable up there even when they opened the wine bar. I'd get up there and I'd get down. I didn't like to linger. The staircase was a funny place. It had a don't come up, don't bother me kind of feel to it.
I noticed when you commented on my Facebook thing, you mentioned that there was a man that didn't like the way that the Cook family created a wine bar upstairs. What were the details behind that energy?
You know, he was well-dressed. And at first, when I got to thinking about all this, I asked myself, was that the same young man that died? And no, it wasn't. But there was a spirit up there that may have been attached to the energy of go away. Like, don't come up here. That could have been the same energy. What's interesting is that I never felt comfortable up there, ever. And that area belonged to him. That was the feeling. It was like they were doing something bad by either bringing liquor up there or disturbing his space. And I don't think he lived there in a Cook time frame or anything like that. I think that spirit went back further. Maybe even was part of the Falk energy. I don't know, but he certainly didn't like anybody up there lingering. He did not like the wine. He did not like all those bottles up there. He just didn't like it. He didn't like it.
Wow. I was at a loss for words after this call with Elaine. From decades ago, the experiences Elaine had when she worked at Green Pastures were actually connecting with things that Sarah saw and felt on her visit on February 1st. And many also aligned with Cindy's readings as well. The fact that Elaine said that the young man who died tragically was somewhat off, perhaps mentally ill, was hair-raising. She goes on to say that she believed the upstairs room, which from what I could decipher from her description, was the same area that Sarah saw the man hiding upstairs. Although I was unable to find out who this man could be through more calls with Martha Ward and historical research, I was at least pleased that we had another connection here that was eerily validating. But let's not forget the man upstairs who Elaine said was a different presence than the young man who died tragically. Elaine actually described him as well-dressed. That's actually the same way that Sarah described the male presence in the bar upstairs. And Elaine also gave us more insight to his behavior. He didn't like something about the space, perhaps how the bar had been renovated, or maybe even the bottles of wine. In regards to this, I had my own theories brewing, because I had unknown information about the military man that psychic Cindy saw during her visit. Cindy actually had a lot more to share with me about him, but I didn't include it for sake of time. But now, it feels relevant. Cindy had detailed a story regarding the soldier from World War I, and it involved his love for scotch. A particular scotch, in fact, that Cindy actually had to hunt down and purchase so she could deliver it, take it to the upstairs bar, and raise a glass with the spirit to honor him. I'd also heard that there could possibly have been a small private bar in the private dining room in years past, and that this bar was possibly this male presence's favorite, most frequented bar when staying with the family. Perhaps the renovations, adding wine to the bar, upset this old-fashioned soldier who fancied his old bar with whiskeys and brandies. But this was just a theory of mine, and there were more stories I needed to capture. Another listener of the show, Paul, reached out to me via social media after hearing the first episode of the series as well. One major thing to note as you listen to Paul's testimony is that the current private dining room at Maddie's, that's a big hotspot for our current investigation, was previously a small upstairs wine bar with a small closet and a men and women's restroom in it as well. When you hear Paul refer to the upstairs bar, he's referring to what is now the private dining room at Maddie's.
My name is Paul Brown, and I worked at Green Pastures from about 1988 through 2005. Started out working as a waiter and then moved up to manager. And in the early 90s, became a partner in the business. To be honest, there wasn't so much activity that it was a thing that we talked about. I had just gotten reports from a guest here and there and, you know, an employee here and there, but it wasn't sort of a common thing. But it happened enough where, you know, it registered with me. And the thing that it always seemed to be in the same place, which was in what we call the upstairs bar, which is now a private dining room. And I did not personally experience any what I would call paranormal activity, although I put myself in a position many times where it seemed like something should happen, closing up at night, walking around a dark, empty house. But I personally never experienced anything. However, I worked with several people and engaged with guests of the restaurant who did. A lot of people after dining would want to take a walk around the house or ask about the history of the house. And sometimes I would pull quick history and show them around, or if they just kind of wanted to wander on their own, I'd give them the lay of the land. And I remember one time a group, two couples, wanted to look around, and I said, sure, go on up the stairs. And at the time, our bar was located directly up the main staircase before you went up to the second floor where I believe the bar is currently. These two couples walked around and went into the bar upstairs. There was no bartender at the time, but they walked up and went in, and I kind of went about my business. And then all of a sudden, I noticed one of the ladies came running down the stairs, and she came up to me and said, can I stand next to you? And I said, sure. Is everything okay? She said, yeah, I was upstairs in the bar. And I got this weird feeling, and then I felt like somebody was pushing me. And they said, oh, really? That's interesting. And she said, I don't want to go in. I'm going to let my friends continue to look around. And she just asked if she could stand and stay next to me. I'm like, sure. Her friends came down and they all kind of ribbed her and kind of joked with her about it. But she was pretty shook up from being up there. I recall another time that there was a new bartender who was setting the upstairs bar. She went up there and was stocking things, bringing up ice, cutting garnishes for the evening. And as she finished, she came downstairs and asked if she could talk to me. And I was like, sure, what's up? She said, I don't want to be in that bar alone. I said, why not? She said, there's something going on up there that I can't quite put my finger on, but it felt like somebody was staring at me, but nobody was up there. And then at one point, it felt like somebody grabbed my arm. So I said, were you standing next to the restrooms? And at the time, there were two restrooms up there, man and woman. And I had heard people say that in that little cubbyhole between the restrooms is where a lot of stuff happened. And she said, yeah, how did you know? And I told her that that's kind of where things happen. And I remember another time that there was a hostess that was working, and she walked upstairs to go to the bar to get a glass of wine, I believe, for one of the waiters who was busy, and she went upstairs, and then she came back down with a glass of wine, and she said, I don't want to go back up there by myself. I just got the feeling like the floor was shifting, and I just got very uncomfortable feeling up there. I do remember some of the people that worked in the kitchen that had been there for a long time had talked about the little monster that lived upstairs. They were referring to something that was moving around upstairs. I remember listening to one of the waiters when I was managing. He loved like showing people around. And he was telling a lady who had asked if the place was haunted, he said, oh yeah, there's a little girl that, you know, died of scarlet fever that sometimes is upstairs. I told him later, it's like, I've never heard that story. Where'd you hear that? And he's like, oh, somebody in the family told me, but he never would come forth with who that was. During the First World War, and I think even the Second World War, when the men were gone, extended family came and stayed. It was almost like a boarding house. So there were people sleeping all over the place. And they had quite a number of extended family and friends that were staying there. Those are the kind of amorphous tales of things that were going on upstairs, but they generally were occurring in the same place. What was at the time is the upstairs bar, which now is a private dining room. I spent a lot of time myself up there, and I really kind of wanted something to happen. I wanted to, you know, I get like a spooky feeling, but I would just figure that I was just freaking myself out.
Although he'd never had his own paranormal experience at Maddie's or Green Pastures, Paul was able to share some of what his staff and patrons experienced during his time there. And what I was able to take away from his testimony was how there were a lot more people afraid or uncomfortable about the upstairs room that is now the private dining room, the room where the child handprints are said to form on the windows, the room that Sarah met and talked with the four-year-old spirit she calls Amy, but also the room that Sarah believes this creepy young man from the downstairs bathroom seems to come up and hide sometimes. Part of me wonders if Amy could potentially be a newer presence, perhaps just brought about by Dustin's energy, or maybe the recent renovations. And this other young, creepy man has somehow lost some of his hold on the space and isn't strongly tied to it anymore. Again, these are just theories. Either way, I was glad that Paul reached out and shared these experiences with me. But I had to move on to our last call with Meg, who would just add to the incredible list of full-bodied apparition sightings here at this historic site.
So we've lived in Austin a little over 11 years. And we have loved Maddie's for at least, it used to be called Green Pastures. So we liked it back then, if that tells you how long we've liked it. I identify as an empath and intuitive. At the time when we first started going there, when I had this experience, I didn't. I was something I was kind of pushing away. We were sitting outside, you know, the fabulous patio when you come down the stairs outside of the hostess station. And my husband and I were having cocktails. And I was sitting at a table from that walkway that goes up to the porch. I just remember at one point looking over my shoulder towards the house and seeing a young girl. I just remember seeing bare legs and just thought, that's kind of weird. And looked back over my shoulder, and she was gone. It was weird because she was standing right by the house, like right by it. She had long, darker hair. It came down to her back, below the shoulder blades, down the back, and it was straight. And I thought, man, she's kind of dressed funny. She had a bare feet and definitely a light colored dress. It was like white. So if I had to guess age, I'm terrible at this. I would go by height, so she was definitely under 5 feet tall. So I would guess maybe like under 16 for sure, 10 to 16.
What was she doing? Like, do you remember? She was just standing there?
Just standing there. Not looking at people, but, like, looking around the house. It wasn't abnormal behavior. It was just somebody standing right up on the house, which is kind of weird because there's landscaping and, you know, there's stuff going on up and around there.
What time of day was this, by the way? I didn't ask.
It was dusk, summery happy hour time. Being a fan of the show and following on Instagram, when I saw the post that the Maddie's episode was coming up, I got kind of excited because I thought it would be really interesting to see if any of the employees or anybody else had seen a girl or anything around the outside of the house or just something similar to what I'd seen that one particular time. So when the episode came out and I heard the story about the girl watching the peacocks in the tree, I literally had to set my paintbrush down and I had the chills up the back of my neck. The little hairs on my arms were standing straight up and I felt like I could almost see her exactly the way he was describing her. It was the same girl. It was a little eerie.
All of this new testimony just painted the picture of how this beautiful historic farmhouse, nestled in a gorgeous neighborhood in Austin, Texas, had now begun to develop an incredible list of unexplained experiences. And my intention, before the pandemic hit and we all found ourselves in this new situation, was planning a trip back to Maddie's, one with Cindy, Elaine, and Sarah coming together for the first time and sharing what they saw together. But we would have to wait for this opportunity now, and one day I do hope to revisit Maddie's with these three ladies and their gifts to see what more we could uncover. But before we go, I wanted to share one more thing that Sarah got from our investigation on February 1st. As I mentioned, she was making notes, or as she called them, pins, from the spirits there. There was a third pin for Dustin that night, but it was a personal message she was told to deliver to him from a male presence that was not associated with Maddie's, but strictly connected to Dustin himself. The message at the time had no relevance to this story, but following our visit, as I edited this second story together, I felt there might be some connection to what has just transpired, the pandemic, and I would learn from Dustin on a later call to hear his final thoughts on this case that the message had a very personal and special significance to him. Normally, I would not share personal moments like this, but Dustin was very adamant that the message was important and that he wished we share it.
And then third pin for Dustin.
Like when I walked in, it was in passing where he was like, make sure to tell him to get some rest, which is really funny that you said you had no life. Something's coming at, like something's coming soon and you need to be prepared for it. So get a lot of sleep as much as you can before it happens. I don't know. Honestly, I have no idea. Rest a lot. They're very stressing. He's stressing. You need to rest. I don't know why. But so as much sleep as you can get, try to get as much sleep. Be more kind of like, yes, make some better choices and just kind of just really, really focus a little bit on getting that kind of rest and replenishing yourself. And it's what's going to happen. It'll be sooner rather than later. So I'm thinking within the next few months or something major is going to happen that's really going to stress your body out. And so you need to prepare for that. Short period of time, but just rest and prepare for that.
There was a lot of things that Sarah mentioned, and just the technique and the way she kind of dealt with the space, I was super intrigued by that. I've really never seen somebody as literally hands-on. I mean, just the whole time she's like drawing and writing and you know, making these little notes, and some of the correlations between what she had said and what Cindy Kerr had said were just pretty interesting. I've never been through that kind of experience before, whether or not she was talking about the current situation, the pandemic, the strange times, whatever different names everybody's referring it to. At first, I just kind of took it as like, yeah, I might be tired. Like, I work a lot. Maybe it's, she can see it around my eyes. I haven't left my apartment since this whole thing started. I went to Fiesta one time because my friend dragged me out of here. Other than that, I haven't left my apartment in over a month, and it has been kind of a space where You know, originally when I was told to reach out to you, a person, you know, from Spider House wanted me to talk to you about Spider House. And I didn't want to talk about Spider House because I was a very horrible person in those days. Like, I was a very, very bad person. I'd carried things with me from a child, you know, depression, trust issues, feelings of abandonment, a broken home, loss of home, many defects of character. And I did a lot of things to cover that up. I hindered a lot of relationships and was unfair. Going back to those times, like, I just really didn't feel like it was something I wanted to do because I felt it might just, like, trigger a lot of these emotions that I had kind of buried over the years. But I remember her telling me, get some rest because you're going to have to be healthy. And this whole time I've been here, it has been an issue, but it's only because I've never really just, like, cared for the person that I was. And that's something that I have been working on over the last 2 years, 3 years. I've stopped a lot of those things. And becoming what I had hated was a big thing. You know, I grew up in a bad environment. So becoming what I had ultimately hated just haunted me. And, like, I've had this time here to see those defects of characters. You know, the isolation has kind of put me in this little pressure cooker to understand that I might have a fear of uncertainty. I'm sure a lot of other people do. I've spent this time recognizing as many faults or defects of character that I have and developing some sort of mental formula to deal with these things and to turn those into accolades so in the future I can be the best person I can. Everybody around me will respond to that in a better way. And there is a chance for the idea of home.
Imagining into the future, let's say you're telling kids about your experiences at Maddie's, what do you think you would reflect on and tell them about your time there?
I think I will tell them it was one of the first places that I learned the concept of home, which to me is the most beautiful word in the English language. It encompasses love, it encompasses trust and communication. Like, home is the greatest word in the English language.
I think you can tell from our conversation that it was a very welcoming place. Primarily what I take with me is the sense of hospitality that was preeminent at Green Pastures. And it was preeminent from the time I was born. And I'm sure it was that before that, because as I told you, we were the host house for so many families during World War II. So, and as children, we were given guidance to be at the front door and to welcome people and to really make them feel at home there. And the later staff, many of them knew the patrons by name, could ask about their families. It was had that sort of intimacy and home space. And as I mentioned, so many people had their most life-affirming celebrations there, from birth to graduations to rehearsal dinners, which people used to have before their weddings, their anniversaries, and so on. So to know how much of life was celebrated there, and to know that that was led by primarily my mother and my father's personalities, but particularly my mother's, and how they brought us up in that tradition of hospitality, and that we each in our own way continued that through now, and we've taught our children, if we're blessed enough to have children, those same qualities. So this is what's most endearing and enduring, and that's hospitality.
I don't usually cry over Austin Icons, but three things have made me cry. Looking back, when I left there for the last time, and I knew that that would be my last day at that beautiful place, I cried on the way home. The Cook family was, and still are, highly respected and very well
thought of in the community. They obviously, Mama Cook had some, had a big heart. It's no wonder that Spirit felt comfortable. Nobody was chasing them off. You could not not have spirits in that house and on those grounds. There was just no way. No way you could not.
I think I did, and I think several others, entertained the fantasy that one day we would return and we'd all have wonderful rocking chairs and we would sit on the front porch and tell stories just like our aunts and uncles had done for years.
From seeing what's happened at Maddie's, from seeing what's happened when I used to work at Spider House, and even prior to that in residences, areas of Texas, areas of the country I lived in, and experiencing paranormal activity, I fully believe that if I die, I don't have to go anywhere. I can just stay right here.
Every case, I invest months of time into each location, sifting through the clues, finding that one thread of story that most oftentimes has been woven so delicately between the fabric of our world and something potentially beyond it. In some small way, I always have hopes of unraveling some important message from those who might live beyond the sight of our living eyes. But the messages we find are sometimes cryptic or unclear, and other times mundane or even silly. But in the case of Maddie's, I believe the message was clear from the start. Green Pastures and the hospitality the Falk Cook family cultivated in this home lives on. And if you believe in ghosts and the many presences that may haunt this beautiful farmhouse, you can clearly see why they haven't left. At the close of our final phone conversations, Dustin informed me that he'd been looking out for the man in the upstairs bar, but had not seen him physically yet. He told me he does talk to him now and again, and informs him when crowds are coming or changes are happening. But Dustin also informed me that he developed the habit of saying hello to Amy now. And if you're ever at Maddie's, and you can peer into the private dining room upstairs, you'll see he's developed another habit, leaving a small pile of Sour Patch Kids for his little friend. This investigative series was the last case our team was able to complete before the pandemic hit the US. We aim to continue the show with campfire episodes, our curated collected personal ghost stories submitted by listeners. So seeing as I stay healthy, you listeners submit some good ghost stories to me, and finances don't put me in a dire situation, I hope to bring you a new exciting campfire episode on June 29th. But keep in mind, we will be taking a break, as usual, in the month of July. So there will be no new episodes released that month. During this time of isolation and quarantine, I'm striving to also produce some extra content to release to all my listeners, as well as new exclusive content to our Patreon supporters. I'll be hosting some live Q&As, night owl Netflix parties, video diaries, and more. If you aren't already, please consider becoming a night owl patron. It's the best way to support our show during this time, and since we can't host events, our finances have taken a hit. We could really use the help in a time like this, and we greatly appreciate the support. Also, follow our Instagram and Facebook pages because that's a place to get the most timely updates as well. Please note that we had many Night Owl events in store planned before the pandemic, and so many of you pre-purchased tickets for our Spirit Social and our April and May Pioneer Farms Ghost Tours. These events have all been postponed until we can reschedule them. For those of you who purchased tickets, we have emailed you info on either holding your tickets or how you can request refunds. You will also be receiving updates, keeping you informed as to when future dates are determined for these events. Thank you for your continued support, and stay healthy out there, Night Owls. I'd like to thank my investigative team, Sarah, Alexis, Franklin, and Tao, for going on these crazy adventures with me. Nicholas Fair for his talented musical contributions to this show. Jennifer for managing our merch, Patreon, and many other irrational tasks I throw her way. My dad Sam for his incredible historical research, Bo for helping produce this busy indie show, my assistant editing team, which include Alex, Alexis, Bo, Jennifer, and Mikey. And thanks to Sean for his help with our story submissions, Alicia for her creative design work and marketing, and lastly, Sandra for keeping us all on schedule and on budget. And a very special shout out to my wife, Tao, for sticking with me all these late nights and long hours, and for taking amazing photographs on every case. And last but not least, David Dalton of Driftwork Sound for mastering every single episode on the tight turnarounds I give him. Please support their works by visiting our website, thenightowlpodcast.com, and clicking on the About tab. There you can find links to all their individual works and websites. And a special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Oh Boy Print Shop. If you have the need for custom t-shirt printing, you can feel at ease in the hands of Oh Boy Print Shop. Be sure to mention the Night Owl Podcast to get $50 off your first order. Thank you all, and stay restless out there. This podcast was mastered by David Dalton of Driftwork Sound. If you're ready to up the production quality of your podcasts or music, go to driftworksound.com. That's driftworksound.com. And get your project mixed, mastered, or produced using well-established methods and unconventional techniques. That's driftworksound.com. And remember, your first master is completely free.